welcome to another podcast episode from Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm your host, Jeffrey James Higgins. I'm a suspense and thriller author and the owner of Elaine's Restaurant and Salon, which has become a hub for authors in the Washington, D.C. area. My background looks a little different today. It's because I'm too lazy to go into the office. We're doing a virtual interview today with a really talented and successful author and someone I've been looking forward to having on this podcast since we chatted together, I guess, back at BoucherCon a few months ago. Carter Wilson is a USA Today and Publishers Weekly bestselling author of 10 psychological thrillers known for their intense emotion, tight pacing, and haunting twists. His books have received starred reviews from every major trade publication, have been optioned for film and television, and his 2025 novel, Tell Me What You Did, was selected as a national monthly pick by Barnes & Noble. It's a big deal. In addition to his fiction, Carter is a creator and host of Making It Up, a podcast featuring unscripted, revealing conversations with fellow writers about the creative process. He's also the founder of Unbound Writer, a company devoted to helping writers find their voice through coaching, immersive retreats, and online classes. A seasoned public speaker and natural interviewer, Carter is known for his dynamic onstage presence and his deep curiosity about the craft of writing. He lives in Erie, Colorado, and travels frequently to speak at conferences, moderate author panels, and lead writing workshops. You can visit him at carterwilson.com and unboundwriter.com. Carter Wilson, welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon podcast. It's good to have you.
Hey, man, it's so good to be here. And yeah, we met at BoucherCon, and just a little background for the listeners, no moderator showed up to our panel. And the two guys who are podcast hosts, you and me, we immediately like jumped in because we're like, we know how to lead a conversation. I totally remember that.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, we both fell into our natural state, right, of just sort of taking charge and having fun with it. I mean, in your bio, I said, you know, your curiosity about the craft of writing. I feel exactly the same way. There's nothing I would rather be doing than chatting with a good author about how they connect a story.
Yeah, totally. And it's funny because I evidenced that in you at that panel. It's like you were immediately asking like interesting questions. You know, we weren't the moderators, but you jumped in and you didn't say like, well, tell us about your latest book. You started asking about how their mind works, which is I'm the same way. That's why I started the podcast, because I find writers fascinating if you kind of can dig a little bit into kind of beyond what they're normally asked.
Well, that's the thing, right? When it's beyond what they're normally asked, if you're a successful writer, you do shows all the time, your interviews, you're going on the road, you're doing book tours and book signings, and people always ask you the exact same questions. So I find that sometimes writers come in and they have these pre-packaged answers, and they're interesting, and you know, sometimes people do want to know that. Like I tend to ask people real quickly at the end about their process and things, you know, because I'm curious about, you know, how people actually write, but it doesn't go deep. It doesn't go into what their actual connection to this kind of magical world that they work in. And
right.
It's so interesting.
And there's no given, like what drives me nuts, not to go too deep in the weeds here, but what drives me nuts about, and one of the impetus is why I started my own podcast, was you have these interviews where people ask you questions and maybe they are interesting questions, but it's just a check, right? Like I asked that, there's no follow-up. There's no like, oh, it's weird that you said this. That caught my attention. And that's why you and I don't write questions down, because we know we're going to have things because we're naturally curious that we're interested in about each other.
Oh, I can't believe you said that, because that is literally the one thing that I always tell people when I do it. It's that the lack of a follow-up. There'll be a question and the author will say something really provocative or just crazy. And then the interviewer moves on to their next question on their list. It's like, what about that? What about the guy just mentioned the bodies in his basement? Could we maybe hear a little bit more about that? You
know? And the one thing my one Achilles heel, I think, about being interviewed with those kind of rote interviews are, you know, your five favorite books, your five favorite thrillers or whatever, because I'm not a great reader and I mostly read nonfiction. So, you know, I didn't start writing until, you know, my mid 30s. And so when people talk about inspiration and who was your authors when you were 9 years old, I'm like, I avoided books like the plague, man. Like, and I feel so like underwhelming when I get asked those questions.
Well, no, but that's so interesting, and I mean, you're very successful, and you're a fantastic writer, so that's super interesting, because I've interviewed, I think, 150-plus authors at our salon since we opened, and then, you know, 100 more outside of that, And most people, like myself, right, knew they wanted to be writers when they were at a very early age and had this connection to, like, fiction. Yeah. And you don't. So tell us about that. Like you said, in your 30s, what flicked that switch for someone who doesn't read a lot of fiction to want to write fiction?
Well, and just to back up real quickly, because I've interviewed hundreds of authors, too, and I do see that there's something that if you're a writer, however that looks when you're young, and it might not look like being a writer at all, it might just look like you're a hyper creative kid, whatever, it's going to worm its way out at some point. And that might not happen until you're 70, but I see it time and time again. Finally, it's like, I just retired. Now I'm going to write the book. For me, I went to hotel school. I was working in hospitality consulting. That was my direction, and actually continued to be, because, you know, hard to make money for a while writing. And I was taking this 8-hour long course one day when I was 33, a continuing education course, a really, really boring. No smartphones back then, and I was just mind-numbingly bored. So for the last 2 hours of the class, I just wrote down a murder mystery riddle that I just made up. And I'm like, I'm going to solve this riddle just to pass the time. And I couldn't solve it. And I got home and I'm like, it was just that. And you've probably seen this with other authors, this tenacity, right? Like, I'm going to figure this out. And so I just started writing a backstory that would explain this riddle. And it started just flowing out of me. I mean, not well. I didn't know what I was doing. But in 90 days, I had a 400-page manuscript. I've never written that fast since. And it was terrible. I mean, because, again, I didn't know what I was doing. Didn't tell anyone, not even my wife at the time, because, you know, we all have this shame as a writer that we don't deserve to be doing this. And who do we think we are? But the one thing I did after that experience was I did take the time to be curious about that. Like, why did this happen? Is this the universe telling me, nudging me, saying, hey, maybe you should open your eyes to this? So I decided to Google, what do I do with the manuscript? Because I didn't know. And then Google started telling me about agents and all that kind of stuff. So I'm like, all right, let me just, I don't know, see what happens. But I realized I loved it. I loved that process of storytelling, which for me was problem solving. I was trying to solve a problem, and this problem was the riddle. And that's how I still write today. I don't outline. So I'm like, I start with a weird premise that's vaguely formed. And then I'm like, all right, how do I solve this problem? And that's what I love.
That is so interesting on so many levels. We got to unpack it a little. So do you remember what the riddle was? And do you remember where it came from?
Yeah, it came just out of the ether of my brain and probably repressed childhood memories. That it was, if three people are murdered at the exact same time, in the exact same fashion, but in totally different parts of the world, what's the connection? I don't know why that popped into my head. But
should we be concerned, Carter?
and that really became what my first book, which never sold. I got an agent with it, which I can't believe I got an agent with it. Same agent I'm with today, 22 years later. Got an agent with that book after about 75 rejections, but that and the next two didn't sell. But I started to learn, like, I just like making stuff up. This is really cool. And how can I do this and still make money with my corporate job and find time and all that kind of stuff? And as you know, it's kind of a game. I like the game of it. You know, the rejections, the whatever, it's all a game. And I just wanted to be a part of it.
You know, you have to love it. It's a really difficult business, and the numbers are just horrific on getting agents and getting published and breaking out with books. So if you're not, if you don't love the actual process and playing with it, you're in trouble.
Yeah. I mean, I will tell you again, 22 years into this, my first book was published 12 years after the day in that class. My 10th book, Tell Me What You Did, came out early this year. That was my breakout book. So, you know, I didn't start making real money until 22 years after I started writing. And that's just the reality of it. And, you know, every story is different, but mine is not to make any money at all is almost the not the norm for sure. So it's a tough road to hoe.
Yeah, I think, you know, in that Penguin Random House lawsuit that came out, we saw some of the data behind the screen. And I believe the average book sales for a Big Five author was around 2,000 or 2,200, like, lifetime sales. Like, it was really bad, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, and I don't know if I'm talking out of school here, but, like, I remember somebody affiliated with one of my publishers saying, you know, kind of the goal, like, the ideal goal is to get, you know, 10,000 copies sold for a book, you know. But, I also know you don't even have to earn out to be considered, you know, decently successful for a publisher. So, the numbers aren't what, you know, and as you know, you tell people you're writing, they're like, oh, so you do that full time? And you're like, what, are you high? Like, you have no idea how poorly this can pay unless you really have that breakout.
So, you know, you said it took 10 books, right, for the real breakout, but I think that's pretty common. Like, at least, like, I'm a data guy, so, you know, my master's
concentration
was on statistical research. So, like, I do love the numbers. So this number I'm giving you isn't backed up by data. It's my own experience in interviewing authors. But a lot of them I've noticed break out between books 10 and 12. And I think the reason for that is it takes about that million words, you know, to really master. Like, you can be good, but really to master the craft, and also to play with different things and work through it and become that, you know, get to that level, and also to get your name out there enough and to learn the business. Right? It's a hard business.
Totally, you're right on all those counts, because I can go back and look, and if I include the three books that I wrote that never sold, it was my eighth book, so my fifth published, where I can look back and say, "There's my voice." It took me all those books, and that's the voice that I have today. That's a Carter Wilson book, if you can see that. You have to have such skin in the game on the marketing and the PR side, the social media side, and I know everybody knows that, but I think it's a lot more than people realize, and it's more than just, hey, I got to post on Instagram every day. It's really being thoughtful about who your audience is. Are you generating newsletters? Are you potentially hiring a third-party PR firm? All those things, like, make a difference. And only then will it still take years to start getting into the conversation. I mean, that's what you want. You want to be in the conversation. You still have to write a great book for that conversation to start sprouting like wildfire. But name recognition is a really difficult thing to achieve.
And it's a game of inches too, right? Like, even when you're trying to get an agent and you're doing a query letter, like, I help a lot of people with their query letters. You know, that's one of the things where I think I do well is in pitching and querying. But there's little things. They're looking for reasons to say no because they're getting 100 queries a day.
Right.
So, like, it takes a while to really learn how to, like high concept, three people murdered around the world the exact same way. Like, that's a high concept plot idea, right? But to be able to pitch that and understand how to develop it and get it to somebody, that takes time to figure that out. And if you screw up any little piece of it, you won't get the agent, you won't get the publisher. You know, you're already behind the eight ball.
Yeah, and you know, you talk to agents today, and it's a nightmare, because to your point, they're inundated, and the reason they're inundated is because people are shotgunning these things out without a lot of thought behind. Oh, I should go to this agent. You know, back in my day, you know, I was physically mailing letters, and I was looking at acknowledgments of similar books and all that kind of stuff. Now it's just so easy. Plus, you have AI on top of it now that can craft a pretty good query letter for you, probably. But your book could still suck. So you're getting people asking for pages that don't match the query in a way. And I'd hate to be an agent right now. I think it would be really hard.
It is, and it's easy for authors, I think, to get angry at agents for a variety of reasons. But if you were the agent, it's incredibly hard to understand, like, what's going to work and which author you can work with and what your publishers want and what the bookstores want. And then there's also the whole zeitgeist, right? Like, you could have the best book ever, but it depends on what's in the news and what people are interested in at the time. And if you're, like, 2 years out or whatever in a traditional publishing model, how do you predict, like, what the public's going to want to read 2 years from now?
Right. And I think that's where you get into trouble if you start to overthink stuff. And I think overthinking on multiple levels, including not only in terms of the business, but including as you go through and write the manuscript, can get you into trouble. And I think that's where, and then when I work with students, we work on the psychology a lot, because I think that's where people get hung up. It's got to boil down to, like, why are you doing this? Mm-hmm. What is your, hopefully you have a, just this inexplicable passion for storytelling, and you're going to just keep doing it and kind of have the blinders on to what's happening around for a certain point of time. You know, and for me, it's like I just kept getting rejections and I kept writing because I'm like, it's fun. And yeah, I'm not saying it's not frustrating, but I wasn't ever thinking like I'm going to be a best-selling author. I was thinking like, yeah, maybe one book published, that'd be cool. I could show my kids. But I think if you're thinking like strategically, that's almost problematic sometimes.
No, I agree with you, because if you're thinking about the business and the marketing end, and I know writers who've done this, they're trying to write to market, they're trying to figure out what would work and then write something in that space. And it's, you can understand that stuff, but if you're not writing just a story that's a good story that you're passionate about telling, the reader right. can tell. Like, you have to want to tell that story.
Yeah, it's very two-dimensional, right? And we've all read those stories. I was working on a manuscript for a student who's not published, and it was very competent. The writing was great, but it wasn't that interesting. And every character who came into the room, we had to know everything about them. And I kind of said this to them, and they're like, well, that's how, and it was a procedural. So, and it went deep into every little procedure, whether it was totally relevant to the plot or not. They're like, I thought this was how procedures work. I'm like, yeah, but it's not interesting. Like, if you look at a cop's job, most of it's not interesting. We don't want to know the uninteresting parts. So there's something that you have to have intuitively about, like, what would grab your attention, you know? If there's people just sitting around talking just to convey information to the reader, if that's more than a paragraph or two, you're in trouble, I think. There's no patience these days for – and that's not to say you have to have crazy action, but there has to be movement. And I think a lot of people think readers today have – especially in the thriller market – have more patience or more attention span than they actually do.
Well, the attention spans are definitely shrinking. We can see that, right?
Yeah, so they're gone.
A bestseller in like the 1970s would never get published today.
No, no. Yeah, the old Stephen King, you know, which I still love, but Unabridged Stand is 1,200 pages. I could absorb every word of it, and it's beautiful, but there's, you know, you have to have a lot of patience. It's really difficult. I mean, how long is somebody reading your book before they check their phone? Probably not long. You're competing. You're not competing with other books. You're competing with Netflix. You're competing with smartphones. You're competing with just this attention deficit. And that's why you, if you're a thriller writer, man, it's all about propulsion. You know, it's funny, my book coming out next year, it's tight. I mean, it's tight. And it's like 84,000 words. And I'm like, this is really propulsive. And my editor's like, I think this could actually go under 80. There's parts where like there's a lot of, and I'm like, are you serious? And I look at it, I'm like, God damn it, she's right. She's right. I couldn't see, to this day, you know, it's hard to still see that for ourselves, but don't underestimate the need to be propulsive, I think.
No, I totally agree, because you are in competition, and it's sort of like respecting the reader's time as well, right? You want to make it as every word should matter. And if it doesn't, get rid of it.
Yeah. And if you're not keeping them up at night, because they have to find out what happens, then, you know, I don't think you're hitting the mark. And I think that's kind of the bar to set now, is like, you want those comments. You want, you know, those comments, or you give them nightmares. That's another good comment to get.
My favorite compliment is that you ruined my workday because I stayed up all night to finish the book. Like, that's my favorite.
It's great. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's so satisfying when you get that. And no matter how much you write, all of that is still really hard to gauge, for me at least, internally. Like, you hone a finer sense of it as you're writing, and you have a sense of like, yeah, this part might be slow, but you don't really know until you get that trusted feedback, where whatever that is.
So at this stage in your career, for that feedback, are you still looking at beta readers or alpha readers? Do you have a writing group? Like, how are you getting that feedback? Or are you just relying on the editor at your publishing house?
Yeah, I mean, I was in a writing group for about 20 years. The problem is, since I don't outline, it's like if I give them a couple chapters, I'm like, these chapters might not even exist in the final, because I don't know what I'm doing. So I finally stopped doing that. So I write in a total vacuum. And the first person who sees my manuscript is my life partner, Jessica. And then it goes to my agent, who acts as an editorial agent. She's amazing. And then it goes to my editor. I'm trying to be better. So I have a second option book that will be 2028 that I just gave my agent and editor, like the first 100 pages. I'm like, just, you know, because I know I'm going to go through 3 or 4 months of editing anyway with them. So why don't I try to nip some of that in the bud and give them an idea of what's coming first? So it's, but otherwise it's just me.
Do you worry about like giving a partial manuscript like that? Because I don't know, I mean, you can tell us how you do this, but for me, when I finish, I go back and I'm planting things and I'm changing characters and I'm making voice more consistent. And I'm like, I do a lot of editing at the end. Like if I gave you the first half of my book as I wrote it, it would be even worse than it will be at the end.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, I think the relationship I have with my agent and editor, and I've been with my editor now for 6 books and the next 2. So we know each other. And so they're not looking for plot consistency. They're looking for, does this feel like a Carter Wilson book? And I think that has a lot to do with, like, is it a page turner? Are the chapters delivering what they need? Is it lean? You know, do I care what happens to the main character? So they know all the plot mechanisms might and will probably change. You know, because I've, you know, I've had pitfalls where I'd be curious to know the same from you. And certainly in your conversations with other authors, we all have a COVID book, right? That book that we wrote in 2020, 2021, our brains were different then. And I think a lot of us yearned for something softer, something safer. For me, it was a place of nostalgia. So I wrote this kind of coming of age. It was a thriller, but coming of age, kind of a road trip book set in 1987. And it did not go over well with my editor because it was just different and it wasn't, they weren't connecting and it wasn't really a Carter Wilson book. And I know a lot of people who have those experiences. And it was the kind of thing where the pitch didn't really match what I turned in. That was just 2 books ago. So you still run into those issues. You have to, it's good to check in, I think. I'm learning to do that.
So you have two parts of that I find super interesting too. Is the one is the pitch not matching, right? So it's like basically a promise you're making to the reader, what they would see on the back jacket copy, and then delivering something slightly different. How do you reconcile those to make sure what you're giving them is what they're getting? Because that's a quick way to turn off readers, right? If you're not giving them what they expect.
Yeah, and the pitch to the reader is tough too, because you're not necessarily in charge of writing the back cover copy. You're approving it, but the back cover copy, it's like writing a query letter. There's a science to it. And it can often make it sound more propulsive than it is to get people to read it. Same thing with the cover art, right? And there's only so much you're in control of that. The biggest problem I had with that book, and this is something I've learned about myself, is when I found my voice, I think that voice and point of view are really tied together. A lot of people will argue point of view should be whatever serves the book best. I think point of view should be whatever you're best at, what your voice is. My voice is first person present tense, and it took me a lot of books to figure that out. When I wrote this particular book, it was from the point of view of a 21-year-old female savant. And I'm like, I don't think I can get close enough to this person. So I wrote it third person past, and I made this person even more distant. So I rewrote it first person present. But by then, I think my publisher was already, I mean, they supported the book. They were great. But I think that they just didn't feel like it was the best book to put out at the time. And, you know, I have no evidence to support this, but like, you know, do you get less marketing dollars thrown at it if that's the attitude? You know, and like I said, they totally supported it. They were great. But it didn't make much of a splash.
So just going back a minute to the thing you said before that. So because you're not in charge of back jacket copy, you can also make promises to the reader in early chapters, right? Like in the tone and in the question in their mind. So how cognizant of that do you have to be when you're writing to make sure you're delivering on these? Because if they get to the end and you haven't delivered on things they expected, they're not going to be happy.
I think it's one of the biggest problems today that I'm seeing with my students. So aspiring writers, especially in the thriller suspense market, because what they're doing, and it drives me nuts, is they hear about, like, oh, immediately you have to grab them. And so then they write this prologue that's got all this crazy shit going on, which is fine. But it's a lot of times they're empty promises, because then we're treated to 50 pages of backstory. And they don't realize you grab somebody not necessarily with action. You grab them with tone, with mood, with atmosphere, with a pervasive sense of trouble or doom that could be just people sitting around for a page. But if there's this, it could be the weather. It could be lots of things that you can play with. But that has to be consistent throughout the manuscript. And I think if you're looking at more than two paragraphs of backstory, you're in trouble. So, for example, what I do is I usually have a traumatized character. And at some point, I want to reveal to the audience what actually happened to that character in their past. And to me, that's a flashback where I'm still writing first-person present tense from the eyes of maybe a 13-year-old main character. And so it's keeping that same propulsive menace without it being spilled through some clumsy dialogue or internal monologue kind of a thing. And I just see so many people like just cramming that all in or cramming it all in at the end. And it does leave you wanting as a reader. It does feel like, oh, it was a really, really great premise, but the execution just left me kind of flat.
Yeah, I mean, I just taught a class, and that was one of the things I talked to them about. I see this all the time. You know, my multiple times a week, I'll get the first few pages from authors to look at, and they start with this really like engaging opening that they've spent so much time on, and then immediately jump back into that deep background or a flashback, and they take you out of the story, and you're like, why do I care now? And all right. The things you just mentioned, and it's like, okay, now I don't want to keep reading.
Right. I think you can have. Present day main character, you're introducing them, and they can have one sentence, half sentence flashes that don't explain anything, but you know something happened. There was something bad that happened, and it'll be important enough where you know it's going to get explained later, but it's not weighed on enough where it feels like it has to be explained now. I think that's the way to do it. The other problem I'm seeing with a lot of aspiring writers, again, in this kind of market, is just throwing too many characters at you. I'm a huge fan of one, maybe two points of view. I totally appreciate novels that can have up to five or six points of view, depending on what it is. But when we're introduced to literally 50 characters throughout the course of the book, and there's eight points of view within those 50 characters, you're going back 100 years. You're asking way too much of the reader. It has to be so interesting to keep track of all of that. And if you get too many within the first three chapters, people are putting that book down, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. When you're doing this, like, do you think it's genre dependent? Like, you're writing psychological suspense, you're in first person, you're in somebody's head. That almost naturally tends to be for a shorter book, right? Because you have some limitations as opposed to like a bunch of a point of view characters. So do you think what you're writing in is easier to write at a shorter level and with limited point of view characters?
I think it is. I mean, I just love writing first person present, almost always a single point of view, maybe a secondary point of view that's, you know, 30% of the book and the main is 70% of the book. What's interesting is like, Tell Me What You Did, for example, is a fat book, but the word count is like 84,000. So right in that sweet spot, but everyone thinks it's a big book, but I have a lot of short chapters. I have a lot of dialogue. So it's a very fast read, but it turns into a lot of physical pages. So I think you can have a substantial book written from that perspective and have it be super tight. But I think the main thing with too many points of view, in addition to it being difficult for the reader, I think suspense and psychological thrillers need to be emotion forward, you know, plot and character development aside. I think emotion, like, how are they feeling? And if you're not spending enough time with any one character, you're not getting to that. So to me, it's like every page, I have to know how my main character is feeling. And not that you have to say how they're feeling, but somebody should be able to pick up on the mood, and that mood should be pervasive, and that should make you want to be invested to see. You don't have to like them, right? But you should be invested to know what happens to them. I have a lot of people like, I didn't like your main character. I'm like, cool, man. But I wanted to see what happened to her. That's what I think you're trying to go for.
So how do you balance, like, how much you want the reader to be curious or interested in the emotional journey of the character versus how much are you as a writer trying to evoke emotion in the reader?
Yeah, I mean, you can be manipulative, right? That's pretty easy to do. I think it's dangerous if you spend too much time with them thinking about their situation or thinking about how they feel, because after a while it becomes, we get it, right? You always have to have, I think, movement happening that, and then you start to see like, oh, so a good example. So my character has a, and tell me what you did as a dog. And they decide she's being stalked. She needs to just leave her house. And so she goes and gets an Airbnb rental in a remote part of Vermont. And, you know, again, I'm not outlining, so I'm just picturing it. And I'm like, okay, you take your dog there. And what do? You let your dog out to go into the yard. She does that. And I'm like, oh, what if there's not a fence? What if a dog runs into the woods? That hadn't occurred to me, but I'm like, of course that would happen. The dog's going to be fine in my mind, but I all of a sudden I'm realizing like, oh, this is a great opportunity to freak the reader out. And I got emails from people saying, I'm going to stop reading this book unless you email me back and tell me the dog is going to be fine. And to me, it was just like an opportunity. I'm like, yeah, of course that would happen. And there's movement happening. And your character's freaked out because for maybe even 10 minutes, she can't find her dog. But she's in this situation where she's being stalked. And she realizes maybe he's here. Maybe he followed me here, took my dog. So I think when you feel those opportunities arise as you're writing, you just have to go for it.
That's so interesting about the dogs, right? Because you can kill a kid, but you can't kill a dog, right? But I'm one of those readers too. Like, I care for dogs so much that if I think where they're killing a dog in a book, I just can't do it. Like, I don't want to totally do that.
And so I killed a dog. This is my dog confession story. I had a book, and the dog, it all happened off screen. You don't know who the dog is. You've never met this dog. It's literally two cops in a precinct saying, hey, we found this dog on the Greenbelt. It looks like it had been killed with a knife. And it was a poodle, for whatever that's worth. And that was the extent of it. But it was really important that we established this. And the hate on Goodreads and the tags that said animal abuse and cruelty, torture. Wow. And I'm like, what? And so then I actually wrote an essay for Writer's Digest about why you can kill a dog. Because I'm like, you know, the whole John Wick franchise is predicated on the death of a dog. But I've learned my lesson. I won't do that again. And I've killed kids aplenty, you know, so it's weird. But I'm the same way. Like, I don't, you know, there are scenes in books. We all have our triggers that this is brilliant writing, but I'm skipping these pages. Cause I, especially if it's like kid stuff is tough, obviously, you know, any kind of misogynistic, you know, abuse, and I can appreciate why it's necessary for that scene or for the plot, but I don't put the book down, but I will skip pages sometimes. Cause I'm like, I don't need that in my head right now.
Are there other triggers in the back of your head that when you are writing that you'd want to put something in, but you want to avoid it just cause you don't want the backlash?
You know how it is that sometimes you hear your editor's voice going like, oh, she's not going to like, there's certain words for sure that even if they're true to the character, I'm like, yeah, you know, is this, there's very few hills that I'm going to die on. You know, anytime I really get into a disagreement with my editor, they are over very, very minor issues. They're not over big plot points. I would say I've gotten less dark as a writer in terms of violence over time. I think I started out kind of more guns blazing, and I just turned it more into like paranoia and moodiness, so that when the violence does come, it's impactful and it's visceral, and I make sure it's very, very real. So I would say the average reader would think my books are more violent than they actually are.
I think it's important to recognize the reality of like violence, right? Like, so what you're talking about, like the aftermath and how people are really feeling in that, you read this cartoonish version of violence so often, but it sort of disrespects like what people actually are going through.
100%. And there's this book that I have somewhere on my shelf, and it's called Writing Violence. And the guy who wrote it is an ex-prison warden. And it just goes into the physiology of like, hey, this is what happens when you get punched in the face. In a movie, somebody getting punched in the face is just an absorbed blow. You or me, I'm going down, you know? And there's like extreme things. So if my character is shot in the leg, he's not running away. He's all of a sudden, but to me, that's interesting. I'm like, all right. How do you deal with this? This is a major trauma on your body. How do you reconcile this? And what interesting opportunities does that bring to what happens next? Because your character's forced to, you know, literally pivot.
Well, that's right. Yeah, it's interesting because it's, you know, the shock of the moment, it goes back to the emotion you're talking about building within your character too. Like these are huge life trauma moments. And people tend to gloss over them in books. I've seen with new writers, especially, they'll lead up to the scene forever, and then they'll get through the violence of it in like a few paragraphs, and they're on to the next chapter. And it's like, but yeah. What just happened here? You know, like this was a big deal.
Yeah. Oh, I love. I don't know why, and maybe this is an unearthed childhood trauma too. I love knives. I love writing. If there's violence, because it's so personal, and to me, guns are fine, but they can be kind of boring. It totally depends on what kind of book you're writing. But if somebody is hurt with a knife, the ability to describe how that feels, the shock, the horror, the visceral wetness, the, you know, everything around it, there's a lot of opportunity there. And if you're not writing much violence and you have the opportunity to do that one scene, readers will be like, blown away. It's a really, or poisoning is, it can be a lot of fun as well, because that is gruesome.
So I'm a huge outliner, right? So you're obviously not, you know, so we're coming at this. This is probably the only difference I can see in our writing,
right?
Is how we approach it. So I'm really interested in how that actually works with you. Because like as an outliner, I'm going through the scenes at a more macro level, and I'm thinking about the plot and how it would evolve and plot points and character arc and how they'd work together. You, as a discovery writer, you're going through scene by scene and kind of seeing where that would change, right? Like how do you get from that the micro movements within and plot points and character development within a scene to the macro sort of multi-act arc? And how do you make that work? Because I find that incredibly difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think that takes the million words to get, because what I think the conclusion I've come to after doing this so long is that for us pantsers, I think the outline's there. I think we just can't tap into that part of our subconscious unless we're physically moving our fingers on the keys. And I've literally evidenced, like I can sit and think, but once I start typing, I just start seeing it. So you start to learn to trust that after a while. And that, of course, that doesn't mean you're not going to make mistakes. But even when I try to outline two or three chapters ahead, I'll start writing and immediately something more interesting occurs to me that blows that outline out of the water. But what's crazy now is I write a first draft now, and I look back once or twice just to remember what I've written. And I almost land at almost exactly 85,000 words every time, not trying to. And I look back and I'm like, okay, the story is cohesive for the most part. Yes, a lot of work has to be done. But it's not like, oh, I zigged when I should have zagged 50% in and now I screwed everything up. And it's also a matter of just letting go of just like, yeah, there's probably a lot better ways to do this, but this is the way I chose and I have to be good with that. But you get a sense when you're writing of like, because I'm always sitting there like, okay, well, what would I do next? And I try to think of something way more interesting than what I would actually do. But that kind of is my North Star. But then I get a sense of like, okay, something has to happen here. There needs to be a confrontation. I don't know what that is, but I'm just sensing there has to be a confrontation because they've been sitting around too long or they've been repeating what they're doing. There needs to be. So I just get those senses of movement. And then all of a sudden you place them in. So her going to that Airbnb, that was just a sense of like, I don't think she would just stay at this house. It seems kind of stupid. And then you get to the Airbnb and like, all of a sudden that unearths, oh, well, now he's breaking into her house at home and he's giving her video of him inside her house. That wouldn't have happened. And so it just starts to reveal itself to me, I think, not to sound too precious about it.
No, I mean, I think that sounds spot on. And this ability, like, for outliners to maybe take a step back and see that, whereas you've internalized structure, even though you're not accessing it as you, like, you have to do it as you go, but you know, you have that North Star. Like, do you know the ending before you begin?
Oh, no, I know the ending usually around 80% in. I'm like, oh, maybe this happens. Because a lot of times, if it is a whodunit, which I don't really write, but if there is needs to be, like, I don't say, like, I can't wait to get to the twist. I don't know if my book's going to have a twist or not. I don't plan on that. But when there is a twist, I'm like, holy shit, that's great. I didn't see that coming. The twist in my next book was all out of a sense of, like, there's something off here. And then it's just this what if. I'm like, oh, my God, that's great. So, yeah, it's just amazing how the mind works, I think, with that kind of stuff.
So that sounds terrifying to me to write like that without knowing what the end is.
Fun as hell.
Oh yeah, sure, it's fun. And if you're writing on spec, I could see the downside being how do you stay motivated if you don't even know if it's going to be a good ending. But if you're writing on contract, right, you have a deadline. Does that create an extra level of pressure for you, or does it help motivate when you don't know if this thing's going to work out in the end?
Yeah, 100%. And I just had this kind of epiphany actually last week. It's that 30,000 word mark. That's where the real fear sets in for me, because I'm 30,000 words into something that I had given a very loose outline to my editor just because that's where we are. And I'm just like, is this a Carter Wilson book? And so I just went back and rewrote the first 30,000 words. I'm like, it's the same plot, but it's just much tighter, much more breathless. I'm like, okay, I need it to get through that to give me the confidence that I don't know where it's going, but I feel like it's got legs now. You know, all my deadlines are pretty generous. So I'm dedicated. I only write an hour a day, but I do it 7 days a week. So I know I can produce. So I've never missed a deadline, but yes, it is scary, but you get to the point and you know this, you get to the point where you're like, I'll figure this out. I've done this enough that I'll figure it out. And I also know when I'm done, I'm not done, because my editor is going to have brilliant advice. That's going to be a pain in the ass to do, but it's going to make the book better. And that's all baked into the timeline.
So you mentioned, like, is this a Carter Wilson book? So you're talking about brand. Are you talking, like, you mentioned your COVID book, you know, being something that was which not quite the same thing because of the headspace that you were in.
Yeah.
Can brand be, like, the just pacing and point of view? Can it be the language that you use? Does it necessarily have to be, like, genre and subgenre or type of book? Like, can you take your voice and move it into a slightly different genre and still be on brand?
Yeah, I think you can. I think you can, because I think, you know, all the best stories, regardless of what genre they're in, are, you know, emotional and conflict based. There's got to be some level of conflict there. So I think if you have, like, if I wrote a romance, it probably wouldn't have a whole lot of actual romance in it. But when the romance happened, it would be visceral and it would be great and it would be emotional. I don't think people are reading my books for the violence. They're reading it for, I think, the atmosphere and the pacing, and maybe an emotional connection, because I like to have characters who have very deep thoughts that are expressed in a very pithy way, and not be self-serving. So yeah, I think so. It would be an interesting experiment.
Yeah, it would be. Do you ever have the urge to write in like a different genre? Completely, you mentioned romance. Do you ever feel like as a creative, I just want to do something completely different?
I mean, I think there's stuff that I would feel so out of my element. Like, so for example, and I'm sure you've interviewed them too, people who write like historical fiction. Like, I have so much respect for, and I love those types of books, but I have no patience for research. I'm terrible at that kind of stuff. I think that would be really hard for me to do. I have co-written a YA thriller. It's really dark and it's on submission now. I have no idea if it's ever going to sell. So that's probably the most I've ever stretched my legs, because it's written from the point of view of a 16-year-old kid, again, back in the 80s. But it didn't feel all that different to me than writing an adult thriller.
What were the major changes? Like, you had to be careful of the language or some of the how graphic it was, or what were the things, what were like the triggers that you were avoiding?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it was probably mostly language. I mean, there's language in it, but as I was writing, it was about kind of these kids who are trying to figure out why 10 years earlier, all their mothers killed themselves in this kind of cult-like ritual in California in the 70s. And so 10 years later, they're trying to investigate, kind of. They're coming together. And I'm like, I don't want to make this Scooby-Doo-ish, because these kids, it's very emotional. It uprooted their entire lives. So it still had that same emotion. It was about tapping into what I felt like when I was 16, and like maybe more emotional than an adult is, maybe more reactive to something, making more bad decisions, because you just don't have the life experience. But man, it was fun as hell to write, I'll tell you that.
Is it hard to get back in that headspace? Because you mentioned the life experience, you know, so you've changed, you become more logical and rational. Your prefrontal cortex is fully developed. Like, you're able to do risk assessment. So you are a different physical person than you were when you were 16.
Yeah, it was. I think the cheat code that we used, was that basically I wrote it in the year that I was 16. So I wasn't trying to pretend to be a 16-year-old today, which is, you know, and of course we can all evidence through our own kids kind of what life is like, but it's not the same, obviously, right? So when you're writing about kids pre-technology, a lot of the technology we have today, I think it's easier, because it's just like, yeah, this is what we did. We just wandered, you know, and which also lends itself great to a thriller. Sure. That's why I love the 80s for thrillers, because you're out on your own.
Yeah, it's amazing how our life experience on a daily level for kids has changed so much, right? When I was a kid, you were out all day. My mom would ring a bell when it got dark. You knew at nighttime you were supposed to come home, you know, but you were just out there on your own dealing with things all day. And that really doesn't happen so much anymore.
Yeah, I just had this conversation with somebody yesterday about this exact same thing. I'm like, that's why it was so easy to abduct kids in the 80s. Like, you're just asking for it. You're like, I don't even want to abduct this kid, but it's just so easy, I might as well.
Now you're starting to worry me. So back to Tell Me What You Did. So it's your 10th book. It's really broke out. It's got great reviews. It was a Barnes & Noble selection. I mean, congratulations, by the way. It's a big deal. When you write something like this, is your 10th book, was there something new that was really hard in this book for you? Or was there something different? Or, I mean, I know you've got structure now and you've got this stuff down, but did you find like a new challenge when you were writing this thing?
It's interesting, because so this was the book that came off of that one that wasn't received as well. And that was also a 2-year process, and it was a lot of rewrites. It was just, I was spent. And I remember when I approached this book, I only knew the vague idea for a premise, like a one sentence vague idea for a premise. But I just had this, it was going to be an angry book. There was just the tone was going to be one of anger, because I was feeling angry. I'm like, I just want to write a straightforward, in your face, angry book, because that's how I'm feeling. And there was, I don't know if it was different, but there was this massive freedom associated with that. I mean, there was like the F-bomb on line 2, and my editor's like, maybe not on line 2. But this woman was so angry, And I didn't even know why she was so angry, but I just fell in love with her because she was just so tough. And it's probably the fastest I've written a book in a long time. And so maybe that was a little bit different. I think what was a little bit hard for me were I have podcast transcripts throughout the book that all take place at one point in time, but they're peppered throughout. Just the feeling of, it's really hard to write transcripts because you want those, you want that movement, you want the breathing room that you would have in dialogue, and you don't have that. And that was really tough for me. It just has got to be just as the conversation. There's no indication, maybe pauses or something like that. But that part was probably the hardest.
So using that like epistolary kind of technique, was that something you'd thought about before? Had you ever tried it before?
I hadn't. In fact, it was funny. Like this, I had written it initially, like it was like two perspectives, but they were from the same main character. One was a very frenetic first-person point of view, and one was kind of almost her journaling. And they sounded close enough that it became confusing. So I changed that journaling into, I'm like, well, what if I do a transcript? I think in one of Stephen King's later books, he had a transcript. And I remember feeling that was interesting because it's a great way to deliver information and making it look kind of official. And so I'm like, well, maybe I'll try that. And I'm like, oh, this is kind of fun, but it was definitely challenging.
So how much as a writer do you have to like try new things to challenge yourself, to keep yourself interested and to keep that creative spark alive versus just making your life harder?
I mean, I would love to hear this answer from you. I think writing is so hard, as joyous as it is, I think the physical act of writing has become easier. Like you, cause that there's literally a muscle there, right? So if I know what I'm writing, my fingers fly. Whereas like when you're first starting, it's like hand to hand combat, right? But the self-doubt, the second guessing, that never goes away. So I'm never sitting around comfortable enough thinking like, I've done this a million times. I don't need to, I need to find something else challenging. To me, the challenging is just, is this a story that I feel is really fresh and original and doesn't feel like it's something that you're seeing all the time? That's what's important to me. There might be a lot of similar beats in my novels, but I don't think it ever gets easier. I'm not looking to make things harder for myself. I mean, what about you?
I challenge myself with something new in every book, whether it's setting as a character or a different type of setting or multiple POVs or a historical element or whatever. I'm always trying something a little different, a different technique like you did, something. I try to add something in there because I feel like you're adding tools to your kit,
But does that not pose the risk of being like, this sounds so, because that's what got me into trouble, right? Was trying something different. And of course we want to broaden our skill set to your point. But I also get scared that if all of a sudden I had a third person past tense, five point of view book, which might be great, there would be red flags. So you do get a little pigeonholed. Yeah. And maybe a lot of that self-imposed. I don't know.
No, I think you're right. And you're right because, your agent will tell you that. Your publisher will tell you that, right? The reader has an expectation when they pick up your book with your name on it that it'll be a certain thing. I guess that's sort of why I was asking the question before about can branding be more about your voice and can it move a little bit? Because I've made some of the classic errors of writing in a bunch of subgenres of thriller. I write suspense and thriller. And like the one that's going on submission now is has a historical element and it's really a fantasy thriller, So it's something a little different. But I think you could read it and hear my voice in it, and I think it still has the hooks and the cliffhangers and the page turner. It's still one of those books. It's just slightly different.
See, that scares me. I just get excited. I usually write about what I tend to do is I write about things I don't know. That's what's interesting for me. I rarely set it in locations that I'm familiar with at all. Usually, they're places I've never been to before or places I've make up. I don't write series, so I have whole new cast every time. So I think that's the challenge for me is like, who are these people? And that's also what's exciting for me. It's like, I get a whole new world to play in, even if I maybe have a little crossover territory with some of my earlier books. Man, that is challenging enough for me.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think we all go through the same thing. We're running out of time. I could just talk to you forever. Like, I have a billion things I'd like
to talk to. You're going to be on my podcast so we can continue the conversation.
Yes, I would absolutely love that. Why don't we just real quick, you mentioned like some things about, you know, self-doubt and how that never goes away. And like, what are some of the techniques you use as a writer to get to the end? Because I can't tell you how many, you know, young writers that I've talked to who just give up, or they, you know, go after the shiny object at that 30 to 35,000 market you were talking about.
Yeah.
That's when most people drop books, because, you know, you get into that muddy middle, it gets hard, and then they think about something new and they move on. So like, dealing with self-doubt and the hard parts of your book, how do you get to the end? What do you recommend for a new writer?
Yeah, I mean, it's what I do. I rarely look back. I know so many people who write three chapters and then they endlessly polish those three chapters. What they're not doing is they're not exploring the psychology of what they're doing. they're just saying, I'm not interested anymore. But they're not really saying, why am I blocked here? Because I don't believe in real writer's block. I think there's something happening that you're not facing, and you have to face that. Fear of failure, fear of success, whatever it is. So for me, it's write that shitty first draft. Like 500 words a day, just add to it knowing that it's going to be a mess and that's okay. But there's nothing harder, as you know, than writing that first draft. Once you have it done, you have that momentum where you're like, okay, now I've done it. I can go, I might have to rewrite the whole thing, but I've proven I can do it. So it has to be that consistent practice. And that's how your mind develops. Your mind listens to consistency. It doesn't listen to motivation. It doesn't listen to the muse. It listens, it knows, oh, today at 8 a.m. is when I sit down and write. And you establish that long enough, your brain gets rewired to do that. And so it's just a matter of sticking with it.
So how do you develop that writing habit? Because, I mean, what that advice you just gave is something I tell every writer. Like, it's exact. I think it's spot on. But having that consistent habit and being able to produce, how did you develop that?
Yeah, I mean, for 30 years, I was in a corporate job. I just left a few years ago. So when I started writing, I'm like, I got to figure out how to do this, right? I was an executive. I'm working a lot. So I started my 1 hour a day. If you can't sacrifice an hour a day for something, then you don't have the passion for it, which is an okay answer too, right? Like, that's a good thing to get through. And I still have that 1 hour a day practice, but 1 hour a day, 1 hour a day less of Netflix, maybe 1 hour a day less talking to your kids. I don't know. You got to make the decision. But for me, it's like 1 hour a day, 500 words a day. The math is easy. You can get a first draft done way less than a year. So, you know, face the facts that, you know, if it's not worth 1 hour a day, then it wasn't meant to be for you.
It's a choice, right? So the priorities that people make in life. Do you want to watch it one more episode on Netflix, or do you want to write?
Yeah. How many people work out an hour a day? Like, so I work out and I write. Those are two very important things for me, mental health and physical health. Yeah. You know, but it does mean that there are other things that I can't do. But that's okay, because you realize, like, maybe I didn't really love those other things anyway.
I've got a final question for you, and this is one I've asked most of the people I've interviewed. And you've sort of touched on it earlier, but where do you think story comes from? And by this, I mean, you have this magic where you're putting these marks on paper, and then these whole worlds are exploding in readers' heads, right? They're reading something different even than what you're writing. Every reader's experience is different. But where do these things that you're creating out of whole cloth come from?
Yeah, I really think everything's based on some kind of emotional trigger. And by that, I mean, when you think of something and you feel a reaction to it, whether you're reading something, whether you're watching something, it's almost like a dopamine hit, you know, and it could be a negative dopamine hit, but you want to kind of recreate that. And it's like, when I think about story, I always think about what can I write that would make somebody have a reaction to it, because I like having, I'm watching a Netflix series and all of a sudden there's a great line. I'm like, that was the best constructed line I've ever heard. And it was so perfect for the moment. And then did you see her reaction to that? I want to be able to do that. So I think it all comes from a place of emotion, which is why I think the best storytellers are ones who have natural deep wells of empathy. I think it, if you read a book by somebody who doesn't have a lot of empathy, I think it becomes very mechanical, very plot driven. And you're like, yeah, it's, you know, think of like a James Bond kind of a movie. It's like, it goes through all the motions, but you're like, I didn't feel anything, but it hit all the marks. Those people who really know how to tap into other people's emotions, that's where I think the best storytelling comes from.
Oh, I love that. I think that's spot on. Do you want to tell people if they're a writer and they're looking for help, you have this workshop you put together, where should writers go for that?
Yeah, I do one-on-one coaching. I have online classes and retreats. It's all at unboundwriter.com.
And your podcast is terrific. It's on Spotify. It's on other I listen to it on Spotify, but you have it on other platforms as well.
Yeah, Making It Up. Yep. Same. It's just like this. We have very similar podcasts where we just shoot the breeze for an hour.
Well, it's fun, right? There's really nothing more fun.
I can talk about writing all day, and I know you can too.
Yeah, I know. That's why I looked at the time. I was like, oh no, I wanted to talk about so much with you.
I know. It's funny. There's probably about like 10% of the guests where I'm just like, oh man, we got to wrap up. This is getting long. But can we meet for a drink or something?
Yeah, this is one of them for us. And by the way, you have an open invitation to Elaine's Literary Salon. So if you're ever on the East Coast and you want to come out, we'd love to host you there.
That sounds great.
All right. Well, Carter Wilson, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Jeffrey, that was awesome. Thanks so much for having me on.